Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome to another, I don't know if exciting's the right word. That's what Old Baldy would say, episode of the Personal Wealth Coach. Speaking of Old Baldy, let me check and see if he is on the line. Are you there?
I think I am. It could be.
All right. Well, should we say the opening line once more?
Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Oils fill the wall up with our English dead, and that's strangely a lot more appropriate these days than usual. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling very well. A little bit of cabin fever, but actually, if I had the choice, I was thinking back 50 years ago, and somebody said you were going to be locked away with this beautiful young woman who I married about 50 years ago. And if you're going to be locked away, and you get to choose anybody in the world to be locked away with for an extended period of time, I would have chosen her, so it works out pretty well.
Nice. That's all good news. Do you want to start with the disclosures?
Well, let's see. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of the radio program, it's also the name of a registered investment advisor, registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States. Who doesn't approve or disapprove what we do? I would be glad to disapprove given the opportunity, though.
Yes, yeah, that is. They like to disapprove of things when they can.
And
which is their job.
And we are providing educational information on this radio program. We're not providing financial planning. We're not providing investment advice, because that is something restricted to individuals and their particular situation, and it's different for every person. So any advice we might provide on this program, which we wouldn't do, would be bad because it wouldn't apply to everybody.
I can say for a certainty that if we gave advice that was the greatest advice in the world to one caller, it would be the worst thing in the world to do to another. That is common enough that we don't give investment advice on the air.
So you're saying one man's meat is another man's poison?
That's not what I said, but that sounded a lot better than the way I said it.
Yeah, well, that's true. And we have to tell you without any qualification that we do not pay for this program, or we are not, neither are we paid to do this program. Instead, we don't go either way. We advertise on the radio station. Although we advertise for the radio program for the radio station, which is a bunch of weirdness, but we're supposed to disclose it.
Right.
And let's see, what else? The information that we have that we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no guarantee or warranty as to its completeness or accuracy. But the only time you use warranty, you know, that in that context is when you're disclaiming.
Well, I get warranty offers all the time. They like to make money off of me.
Yeah, but that's different when you're making a promise, and it's called.
I'll tell you the difference, though. Here's the difference. We put the word warranty in our disclaimer. They put disclaimers in their warranty.
That makes sense.
That's the difference there. See,
you have a grasp on the American economy.
All right, well, what has happened this week?
Hang on a minute.
Okay.
I would give you the telephone number to call, except for the fact that it won't work. You'll just get you'll just ring, or you'll get a busy signal.
Right.
Because we used to have a number where somebody could call in to broadcast, and a different number that you could call in if you wanted to talk on the show, but we're now down to one number for some reason.
Yeah.
And
so this is not a call-in talk program, except that it has a call-in happening. So, yes.
We'd love to hear from you. So if you will give us your email, if you give us an email at either Jeff@TPWC. Are you, you're monitoring your
email? I am.
Okay, either Jake or Jeff@TPWC.com. That's J-A-K-E or J-E-F-F at TPWC.com. We will try to answer your questions and repeat your comments as long as they're arable.
Arable, yes,
which is like palatable.
Or soil. You've got to have arable soil.
That's right. You got to aerate the soil. Well, it was a good week in the stock market.
It was. Very good week in the stock market.
Even in Lake Wobegon. The stock, the S&P 500 stock index rose 10.26%. That's amazing. In any week in the last several years, if we had said the S&P 500 rose 10.26%, there would be great rejoicing in the world.
Right. At this point, there's just less shrieking in pain.
Yeah. Well, it's still down 21% for the year, this year to date. It's down about 13% from last year at this time. And it's about 25% down from its high last month. Now, a 25% decline is still a bear market. I actually saw a headline in the Wall Street Journal said the next bull market has begun.
They have their definitions very strange. There is no definition of when a bull market begins. Except
when the bear market is over.
You're right, and that just means it starts up. So we've entered a new bull market. You could call any upward move a bull market if you go that wild with it.
We look at it. We have a little different approach to this. We consider the down markets when it goes back up and breaks another record high. When it gets back as high as it used to be,
that's recovery.
That's the end of the bear market from my perspective. From there, that's the bull market. Now, bull markets are typically defined as from the bottom, but you don't know where the bottom is until you look back.
Right. So, why don't you call back in one of our reruns? If we play this episode again in a couple of months, could you call us during the rerun and let us know if we're at the bottom yet?
Well, we've actually got clients in Japan.
They're tomorrow already. They should be able to tell us. But tomorrow the market's closed, so we don't know.
We get them on the phone or an email during the week, and I want to know what the Dow or the S&P 500 did yesterday in their time, so that we can know what it's going to be today. And they never will tell us. Several of them told me it would be insider information, and they can't give it to us.
Right. So we have a huge amount of stuff we can tell you this week. We've got so much information, we're going to have to try to figure out how to pack it in. Everything from the new CARES Act to the more
effect on the Texas economy.
Right. To
huge.
That's right. To the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. That's the one with the paid leave. If you're a small business owner, man, I've been getting a lot of calls from small business owners saying, what do I do here? There's stuff we can tell you about that. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about. Probably the biggest piece of meat of what we have to say is that this isn't the first time that we've been through this.
Are you trying to say this ain't my first rodeo?
Well, no, I'm not saying that. It's not our first rodeo, like the nation's first rodeo. I keep seeing the word unprecedented, and it's only been in this generation that it's unprecedented. Our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, it was just a normal part of life. So it's kind of like the word organically grown. We didn't use any pesticides. We fertilized it without any chemicals. And I'm like, well, yeah, kind of like Grandpa did before they had the pesticides and the chemicals.
Well, let me talk about the other parts of the market.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let me get some point. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note hit its lowest point back on March 9th, it looked like, for yield, at 0.569%. It's at 0.72% as of Friday, not the futures market or anything else, just the actual yield according to the Treasury. That's 30% down from a week ago. And that means that we're seeing the lowest yields on the 10-year note since they've been issuing the 10-year note. And I was trying to find, I think 80 years they've been issuing the 10-year note. And this is the lowest it's ever been. But here's the good news. I want to throw some good news in.
Yes.
The 90-day T-bill was yielding 0.03% on Friday. On Wednesday and Thursday, it actually was in negative. It was in negative territory, which is pretty interesting. The president's been asking for negative rates. He got them for a couple of days. But that means that even though the 10-year Treasury note is at the lowest it's ever been historically, it's still higher than the 90-day T-bill, which means we have a positive yield curve.
Right.
There's no certainty about this. This is, there wasn't a year ago when the yield curve went inverted, and we said it's forecasting a recession. But when you have a nice, reasonably sloped yield curve without regard to what the interest rates are, it generally is trying to tell us, the bond market is basically trying to tell us that things will be a lot better a year to 18 months from now. And that's their forecast. Now, are they always right? No, but they've been right at least as often as anybody else and maybe more often than other people. So I'm very positive about what the market will look like and what the economy will look like a year to 18 months from now. Based on that, and based on the other big indicator that's in the markets, the dividend yield and the earnings yield on the S&P 500 are up around, are much higher than the treasury, than 10-year treasury. That's an understatement of the century. And that is another indicator that a year or so from now, the market should be considerably higher. We're only down about 25% from the record. We're down 21% for the year to date. So that means that there's a very, very high probability that based on the forecasting that's in the market itself, there's a very, very high probability that a year from now we'll be looking back on this and said, we made it through that. That wasn't so bad. At least as far as the economics are concerned, as far
right.
as the market is concerned.
The current dividend yield on the S&P 500 is 2.29%.
So there's an argument that says as long as the earnings yield is higher than the 10-year treasury note, but when the dividend yield is higher, that means the market is dramatically underpriced. And by the way, Morningstar says the S&P 500 is 23% underpriced.
I tend to agree with that. Not every position in there, but the average as a whole.
The other thing that's going on that the markets are telling us is not so happy. West Texas Intermediate crude oil, WTI, is trading at 21. The futures, the short-term futures, are trading at $21.82 per barrel. That means a lot of drillers in West Texas are going to go out of business. They're going to go bankrupt.
And it means that Houston's going to have a downturn in its economy that is pretty severe, completely unrelated to the virus.
This, you can go back to 1980, because this happened back in 1980, and it fell to $10 a barrel in 1980, actually, when the Saudis decided to turn on their spigot for the last time.
Yeah, inflation-adjusted $10 a barrel. Right.
But when you get... No. Actually, $10. It bottomed for just a few days at $10 a barrel back in 1980. Bumped back up to the 20-something again. At least that's the news reports I'm seeing.
Okay.
But the point is, Texas is the largest oil producer in the United States. We produce 42% of the oil for the whole United States. And a big chunk of our economy and a big chunk of our sales tax and a big chunk of everything that goes on in Texas financially is oil. And we have had some busts when the rest of the country was having booms. And it generally coincides with your actual recessions, but it is going to be one of the things you're probably going to be seeing a year from now is the Texas legislature trying to figure out how it's going to fund everything. Because we're going to be in a hurt state of Texas, because it's not, the futures market for August only have oil priced at $30 a barrel, and that's still bankruptcy territory for
right.
oil companies. So,
and a lot of revenue for the state comes from oil companies.
Yeah, a lot of the revenue from the state.
Now, Alaska's probably going to be hurting for revenue as well.
Oh, hurting. Alaska is already...
That's putting it mildly, yeah.
It's hit them because they basically, their fishing industry is shut down. Everything is shut down up there right now. They're worse shape than we are, but... You can anticipate that we're going to have some tax changes or something a year from now to meet minimum requirements, unless some miracle happens and the Saudis shut off the oil, which I don't think they're going to do.
Yeah, they've committed to this.
This is one of those things that we need to be just aware that it ain't over. And there's a bunch of big bumps in the road coming. There's kind of a belief system among some people that, okay, the market is trying to go back up again, Everything's okay. The crisis is over. And Easter, we'll be back in church, and everything will be happy and glory. I don't think so. I think this will be maybe late in the summer. We'll see things returning to some degree of normalcy. But between now and then, it's going to be pretty rough.
Yeah. I agree. Ed, on the way out, said that he had read our newsletter, or his wife had, and he had read it as well. And said, man, that thing was pessimistic. And I said, did you read all the way through? Because the end of it's the optimistic part where we're talking about the future. We have to get through some pretty rough stuff in the couple of weeks to come and couple of months to come. On the other end of it, I see really great things, but we got to get through this tough valley first, and it is going to be tough. I don't think that people fully understand that. We haven't seen the peak of the infection rate, and the mortality rate follows 2 weeks later, sometimes 3 weeks later. So if we haven't seen the peak of people getting the infection yet, then the numbers on the dead are, sadly, that's going to be a really big thing. We've got shortages ahead of us for medical equipment. We're getting through the shortages of the grocery stores. And I think this is one of those things that if you've been to the grocery store in the last day or so, and I've been to one and called around for others, there's groceries back on the shelves and standing in boxes on the floors around the shelves because there's so much of it. There's still items that aren't there. There aren't any French, there's no French cheese. But there are, I saw toilet paper back on the shelves. You made a prediction, and we talked about this on the way in. You made a prediction that the markets would start to stabilize when we started having toilet paper back on the shelves. Well, get ready to get a virtual back pat on that one, because you got it right. The market seems to have stabilized, at least temporarily. And the people that I saw in the grocery stores, while they were keeping a distance from each other, they were not the wild-eyed, terrified people of a week ago. They were overly courteous and offering help as much as they could without touching. That's huge.
That may be one of the symptoms of the coronavirus.
What, being courteous?
Had Congress, actually, the Senate passed something unanimously.
Followed by the House passing it unanimously.
Almost unanimously.
No.
There was one guy who was very serious. By voice vote, they
just wait. No, he didn't not vote for it. He didn't object to it. He called for a recorded vote. But nobody supported him on it, so he didn't get a second. Because he didn't get a second, the efficient of the House floor was able to gavel him down and assume a quorum. And then they did the vote, and it was unanimous in both the House and the Senate. He didn't vote against it.
So nobody said nay?
Nobody said nay. If they had said nay, they wouldn't have been able to do it on a voice vote.
Well, here's what's interesting to me, is that when you get the Democrats and the Republicans to be actually courteous enough to each other to stand 6 feet apart and to agree to pass the largest stimulus bill, largest economic recovery bill in the history of the United States, including, even in World War II, there was no bill passed this large.
Right, and not that's even with inflation adjustment. We're taking that into consideration here. I think you are absolutely right. I think that the Republicans and the Democrats hearing social distancing means 6 feet apart, that's the closest they've been together since, 20 years?
Yeah, and I think this, just like the people being courteous in the grocery store instead of elbowing each other out of the way. One of the things that we're seeing that gives me a lot of faith that we're going to come out of this hole and actually go on to better time is the fact that we bicker during good times, but when bad times hit us, and bad times have hit us, the amazing ability of the two parties to come together at this point so quickly is something that probably ought to go down in history books.
You're right. And when people say, well, they've been working on this emergency bill for 2 weeks now, you're right. It usually takes them 2 years. somebody made the Titanic pull a donut. I mean, it takes a while to turn the ship, and for this ship got turned relatively quickly. And I think it yanked some tails up in Congress. There are a lot of people that really aren't used to dealing with their, let's put it like this, colleagues across the aisle that had to work with them, and they did it holding their noses and screaming and yelling, but they did it.
Wait a minute, they're not supposed to touch their noses.
Yeah, that's the point, except that if you watch C-SPAN, you see that in replacing masks on the Congress floor, on the House floor, were people holding their hands over their faces.
Oh.
Yes.
I don't even want to comment.
Yeah, that's all. Just an observation. Oh, man.
Well, I still think it's an historic. To give you some perspective on this, in 1929, the stock market crashed. And I mean it crashed with a serious
boom. Yeah, not like anything we've seen in since then.
And it bottomed in 1932, 80% down from its peak. The Congress was still bickering. The conservatives and the liberals in Congress were still fighting, and the conservatives passed the Smoot-Hawley Act to raise tariffs and put economic restrictions on the United States on exports and imports, even though the economists and the liberals were saying, no, you don't need to do that, you shouldn't do it. It took us 4 years. It was 1934 before Congress was able to pull its act together.
Right.
And start passing bills to rescue the economy. Now that took
1933 was a good one too. The Securities Act was kind of nice.
Securities Act was good, but it was 1934 before they started passing acts that effectively stimulated the economy.
Yeah, I agree.
So what
they did, what Europe did in the Great Recession and went austerity, we did it here in the Depression, and it led to the Depression. It almost led to a depression in Europe coming out of the recession, but we pulled them out of it.
Well, the amazing thing is we took 2 weeks instead of taking 4.5 years.
Right.
To get this done. And that says a lot for a lot of members of Congress who are willing to set aside their personal and perhaps even reelection prospects. I mean, voting for a huge deficit for a conservative must have been very, very painful.
Yeah. And even though it's not a voice vote, when it's unanimous, it means you voted for it. I think it's important to know that it's the right thing to do in situations like this. We've been talking for the last several years about trimming back spending and getting the budget balanced. And then if you've been listening, you hear, because when downturns happen, it's the government that needs to step in to fix things that aren't even thought to be insured, like pandemics. We didn't say pandemics at the time, but that's one of the things that they fixed. The stimulus during the Great Recession had to do with a lot of people getting out of work and businesses being shut down through no fault of their own because of a banking crisis. Well, now it's not even the bank's fault. There is no one at fault for the virus. So what do we do to maintain? Now, the government is generally not somebody, I would say, come in and prop up the economy. But this is something that Milton Friedman and Dr. Keynes, the opposing angels of economics, one has been chosen by the Republicans, the other by the Democrats, to show all their spending and taxing plans are the right way. They agreed on this. That in downturns, the government needs to be the one to step forth and put some money in. Now, Friedman would say it has to be paid back immediately, and Keynes said it just needs to do that, but they both agreed that in the good times, they need to run a balanced budget. And this is, I don't think either political party agrees with that particular part at the moment. And at the moment, going back, now is a downtime. This is the perfectly and most appropriate time for the government to design a stimulus to the economy. This is the economy going to the doctor. Unfortunately, the doctor has to vote on the medication. But they voted, and now it's being applied. The danger is that once we recover, we keep doing stuff like this. Because now everybody's saying, good job, Congress, you spent a lot of money. It was appropriate to do now, but we got to change the habit once it's done. We may have another package, another stimulus package, in a few months. Why am I saying that? Because just like we said earlier, we haven't seen the worst part of this yet. We aren't really sure what it's going to look like here. In China, they got it clamped down before it got anywhere near as widespread as it did here. But they did it in, people talk about draconian means being applied here when we were being told to shelter in place. They were arresting people for going outside in China. That's the whole different level of draconian. We are not used to being told what to do. At the end of the last hour, there was a question that was thrown out, and this is an easy answer. What gives the government the right to do what they're doing and to take power over our lives? The president declared a state of emergency. That means he can call out the army if he wants and use them as a police force. That's in the Constitution. So just be aware that normal rights in a state of emergency aren't what you would think they are. You can talk to attorneys about that, but the reality is just keep yourself healthy and the people around you healthy, and so far there's been no governmental organization that's going to step in and punish you for doing that. If you're out infecting other people or potentially infecting other people, who else would stop you? That's what we hire them for. That's what we pay our taxes for. So it was written into the Constitution for that reason. Anyway, I wanted to hit that. You said that you are flush full of things to talk about, so I want to hand it back to you for a little bit. It's a little bit more clunky not being able to see your eyes and so on, but back to you, Jeff.
Well, some really good, a big caveat at the front of this. We don't think this is over. There's a distinct possibility the market could take another nosedive.
Yeah.
There's a lot of evidence that's piled up. We don't have any, there's not going to be any certainty until somebody does some extensive studies on this. But the precipitous fall of the market, which was the fastest fall in a one-month period in its history, either in percentages or points or however you want to measure it, was largely generated, apparently, by hedge funds.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons we need to have a bear market every once in a while. We need to have a major correction every once in a while. Apparently, a lot of hedge funds had gone out and borrowed a lot of money to buy stocks because they forecast this year to be one of growth in the market. They didn't anticipate it. They concluded that the threat of a recession was over, and they were just going to go charging full speed ahead. And they borrowed, apparently, a tremendous amount of money to buy stocks, which is part of why the market was going up. And when they started selling, the problem with borrowing money to buy stocks is it magnifies the return, which causes these hedge funds to do really well in bull markets and really poorly in bear markets in many cases. And it magnified the downside on their return because they had borrowed a lot of money to buy the stocks. Once the stocks fall below a certain point, not only are they taking a loss on the stock, they're taking a loss on the loan, and they could go bankrupt. So they started selling like mad and trying to pay off their loan. And the more they sold, the more the market fell, which means they had to sell more to make them, so the market would fall further. And this has a cause. It's the coronavirus and the economic downturn associated with the preventative measures are causing the downturn. But it's like 1987, and the market fell. And again and again and again, they said this is the fastest the market has fallen since 1987. In 1987, there was a bunch of strategies that people were using to protect their stock portfolios on the downside. In other words, they were leveraging, they were using put options, they were using portfolio insurance. There's a lot of leveraging going on. And the more people sold, the more there was a need to sell until finally the system locked up because they basically weren't buyers. They were just sellers, and it went into a nosedive. And I think when the dust settles from this, we'll see this again. So it wasn't mom and pop. It wasn't the common person, I think, that was panicking and running for the doors. It was the so-called professionals in the hedge funds who thought they had the master. They called themselves, there's a book about them called The Masters of the Universe. They think they're perfect, and I think we're going to see a lot of hedge funds out of business over this.
Yeah, I agree.
But they're not hedging
their losses. They're actually magnifying the losses. The hedge funds have come full circle from their original intention, which was to preserve assets, to being extremely risky in many cases.
I think come the end of this month, when the quarters end, and people who aren't paying a lot of attention to this, who maybe think it's over, get their quarterly statement. It's down 25% or 21% from what they started the year at, if it doesn't shift between now and then. And they also are picking up their local newspaper and seeing that the morgues are overflowing and the hospitals, as they are in New York already, are having to rent refrigerated trucks to put bodies in, which, by the way, happened in 1918, only they didn't have the refrigerated trucks. They just stacked them on the street.
Right. Well, that's kind of what they're doing in Italy right now. They're mass graves.
So when that happens, we could get a second wave of consumer selling. But the important thing, I think, at least to me, one of the most important things, is that the insiders at corporations who have armies of analysts,
right,
who are trying to figure out what's going to happen over the next year, are buying their own stock, because they have to disclose whenever they buy the stock.
Right. And
they're buying their own company stock at a near record rate.
I think it's an actual record at this point. I was getting some information from Richard Thaler's site, which tracks a lot of the insider buying, and they've been tracking it since the late 70s, and they've never seen it this high.
So maybe it is a record. The data I got said it was the second or third largest buyback in a week period of time. Of course, we could be looking at longer periods.
But right, right.
The important thing is the insiders at the corporations, who probably have far more access to data than the rest of us do, as a matter of fact, that's why they're called insiders, are saying this is bad, but it doesn't equate to a 30% reduction in the stock.
Right. I think the key here that they're saying is there's nothing wrong with the company, period. The people are selling, and this is when we see a panic and everything drops with very, very few exceptions. It's because people are selling panicked from a diversified set of portfolios. Everybody's selling across the board rather than picking the stocks that are the ones that they need to get rid of and keeping the ones they don't. They're not giving, for instance, the mutual fund managers a lot of choice. Mutual fund managers, let me kind of give a... Do you mind if I step in and do a little quick education on how that works? A mutual fund is like a pool of money. A lot of people put their money in it so that they can get more stocks, smaller percentage of the stock, but get more different kinds of companies so that if one or two or four or five companies go under, they still have a lot of other companies out there. They're getting diversified. So there's this group pool of money, and there's usually a manager. Sometimes the manager is a committee, sometimes it's an individual, sometimes it's just a couple of people. And they make decisions on what they want to buy and what they want to sell, and they're usually making those decisions in advance. They say, I think we're going to buy this particular thing and we'll move into it slowly, which is very different from what an individual investor generally would do. They would just say, hey, buy this many stocks. When a mutual fund with a big pool of money goes in to buy a bunch of stocks, they can change the stock price, because they're buying so much of it or selling so much of it. So they ease into that position over a period of time. And when they went out, they tend to ease out of those positions over a period of time. They don't want to destroy their profits by selling quickly and lowering the price based on their own movement, because they have a lot of money that they're buying and selling with. Okay, so when a panic happens, these managers have a certain amount of cash that they have on hand, usually, not every case, but this is how a lot of them work, where if you're a mutual fund shareholder and you call up or your representative or your advisor or some through electronic, they say you want to do a liquidation. Well, they have that cash on hand because they don't want to have to sell stock or bonds, and except for the ones they choose to buy or sell. So they'll send some of that cash out. When that cash gets tapped out, because so many people are asking, then the managers have to start deciding what to sell. And they don't want to sell the things that they believe are still underpriced, but if enough people are asking to sell, they have to sell kind of across the board. They don't have a chance, a time period to say, only sell these things, because they have to come up with so much money. The demands on the mutual fund are so high. So they have to sell good and bad alike. And that's what we've seen across the board in the market during the panic, is great companies were down and horrible companies were down, and there wasn't a whole lot of differentiation. And then when we had this jump back up, there were certainly some positions that went up faster than others, but it was pretty much the whole thing came back up again, with some minor exceptions. Companies that were obviously in trouble beforehand didn't tend to come back up as quickly, but even they came up from the bottom. When that's happening, it gives the world of investing, if you're good at it, if you've been doing it a while, you get excited. It's sad because a lot of people are losing money in that, but they've just given you an opportunity to step in at a wonderful price. Even if it's not at the bottom, it is extremely discounted. You were just saying Morningstar has said that the S&P 500, you said 35% undervalued?
No, it was about 30% undervalued.
30% undervalued. That says something huge, that this is, everything's on sale right now. And the question that you have to ask yourself if you're about to buy or you're about to sell, it's a pretty simple question. Are we going to get through this as a nation? And when we do, are we going to be better on the other side? Because if you don't think we're going to be better on the other side, you don't need to be in the market. But I think most of us, when we can look out that far, and we can say, all right, we're going to get this under control, we're going to look back at this time and say, man, that price was great. I wish I had jumped in. Now, that's very, very, you have to take this, each person needs to do their own research here. You need to look at what your goals are, and this is something that I have said many times this week. You haven't saved money if you buy a bunch of stuff on sale that you wouldn't have bought to begin with. So, the common joke about some spouse goes out shopping and comes back after spending $4,000 and said, look how much money I saved. Because it was all on sale. So only buy the things on sale that you would have bought at a good price anyway. Don't go out and spend a bunch of extra money beyond what you intended. The first priority is always savings. And do you want to have something to say before we go to commercials?
A little update. It was down, it was 0.7, now it's 0.78, which means the Morningstar says after the rise, it is now 22% undervalued.
Okay. All right. So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We're going to talk about the stimulus package, what it includes, what it doesn't, how to qualify, whether you. We're going to talk about the paid sick time bill that the Labor Department is just releasing its posters for. But in the meantime, we got some commercials to play. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure. Jeff, you still are there, I hope?
I think so.
Okay.
I'm not sure I'm here.
Well, you're certainly not here.
Well, you said I was there, but I think I'm here.
Okay. Virtually speaking, you are existential.
Yeah, I got that. That's good. That's good. I'm not sure what that means, but it's good.
You exist.
She sounded really smart.
All right. Well, did you want to start talking about the stimulus package? Some good stuff in there.
An awful lot in that stimulus package, and very frankly, there's so much in that stimulus package, I don't think we won't know all the ramifications. Probably the biggest one for everybody is the treatment of the tax filing deadline that's been moved to, well, the IRS moved it to July 15th, that slows the train down quite a lot. But here's a big one that isn't necessarily in the package, but I think people need to be aware of. If you didn't contribute to an IRA and you're eligible to do so in 2019 and you haven't filed your income taxes yet, You have until July 25th, or I'm sorry, I keep saying 25th, July 15th to contribute to your 2019 IRA. Now that the market's down, if you can afford to do so, if you've got plenty of cash and you're willing to see the market go down even further, you still have the opportunity to get in. And if you're over 50, you can contribute up to $7,000. Now, there's lots of caveats around that. If you're employed and you have an income of a certain level, so you need to talk to your tax advisor on this. But there's an opportunity here, and we've been getting some questions about that. You can actually do, some people are going to be able to do $14,000 worth of IRA investment in a short period of time, which is a rare opportunity with the market down like this.
Totally agree with that.
And you can take money out of your IRA, the reverse side of that. Not that I would recommend you do so, but the penalty's been waived to the end of the year. And if you take money out and you incur a tax bill for taking money out, you get to repay it over 3 years. You get to pay the taxes over 3 years. And this is a better deal. If you want to put the money back in later, which doesn't sound to me like the most brilliant move in the history of the world.
Let's take it out at the bottom and put it back in when it's recovered. No, nope,
yeah,
don't do that.
But there's some people who have their IRAs and CDs, for example. They have their IRAs in the bank, and they need the cash for some reason. You got to take the money out. You can do so without the penalty. You can defer the taxes for 3 years. You have to pay it one-third at a time. But the issue is, if you recover and you turned out you don't need the money, you can put it back in and avoid the taxes. So when the IRS starts working in the favor of really regular, ordinary people, you know that we have a true crisis underway.
Right, right. Very real crisis.
I'll let you get onto the bill, but the SEC waived rules that would have prohibited companies that manage mutual funds from injecting money into the fund.
Yeah, so that's big.
Money market funds have got a big backup, not only from their parent companies, but from the Federal Reserve. Several companies, Goldman Sachs was the first one to jump in, but some other companies did immediately to back up their money market funds and keep them at a dollar a share. What happens is money market funds, just like banks, have a certain amount of liquid cash on hand and short-term securities that they can sell. And then the other investments that they have in there are longer-term and go out commonly to 90 days. So they can't sell those without taking a loss under some circumstances. And we had a really weird circumstance occur early this week, late last week, where the bond market went backwards. The bonds actually fell. Short-term bonds fell. We went into some weird positions where interest rates suddenly jumped up. And the money market funds had the potential to get in trouble. Some of them were down to like 20% liquidity. And so a run on the fund would have caused them to not be able to meet requirements. And the companies, Goldman Sachs had two funds like that, and some other companies had them. And they jumped in and funded those funds with cash from the parent company. And the Federal Reserve stood by, ready to back them up if needed. So far as I can tell, the Federal Reserve backup has not been needed so far. So a tremendous amount of coordination just came out of this that was actually set up and not necessarily part of the law, but basically a procedure was established by the Federal Reserve and the SEC as a result of the 2008-2009 financial crisis and the bear market and the recession we had. And that they were ready and knew what to do. And I think this is a tremendous positive, is rather than waiting as we did in 2008 and 2009, most of a year before we reacted to things like this, and we were reacting to it on an ad hoc basis over a weekend. The plans were there. They were put into effect. The banks, the mutual fund companies, the Treasury, the SEC, and the Federal Reserve all were coordinating what they were doing very carefully and very, very well. And as a result, they saved us potential panic. And all this negativity that's been going around and continues to go around, we should thank whoever put this together. Mostly it was Ben Bernanke, I think.
Yeah.
And Janet Yellen. But they also, we should thank the people who are executing it so flawlessly. The administration and the Federal Reserve have not had the best of relationships. But the Treasury, who's part of the administration, and the Federal Reserve and the SEC all worked together flawlessly through this thing so far. And they've done a really good job of anticipating where the problems are going to be and putting the backup and the funding in there to keep the problem from actually occurring.
And they're certainly not getting a lot of headlines for doing it. They are doing a great job on that front.
And I think it just shows that we may not be really good at preparing for something that in our lifetimes has never happened, but we have done a wonderful job.
They're preparing for things that... the last mistake of the bank failures. All right, so let's talk about this, the coronavirus bill, the CARES Act. It is providing huge...
Oh, who cares?
What's that?
Oh, who cares?
Oh, who cares? Well, who is another organization, and CARES is...
Yeah,
so who cares? Now you're getting complicated. Probably the biggest thing that people are focused on is the stimulus check. Who gets it? How much is it? It's $1,200 per adult. However, you have to be careful. If you're single and you made more than $75,000, if you are married and you made more than $150,000, and the which year question, which you just asked, is a good question. It could be 2018, 2019, or 2020. Now, if you did it in 2020, you have to wait to get the check. The automatic payments are going to go out based on the last filing that you did. So if you have not filed your taxes for 2019, they're going to use your adjusted gross income from 2018. If you have already filed your 2019, but now you're going, hey, I made too much money in 2019. I don't even have a job now. What am I going to do? The way this is technically being paid for is through tax credits on the 2020 tax filing. How's that for really weird? 3 years to choose from, just like there's 3 years to pay back, only those are future years to pay back IRAs. I think that's a big thing. $500 per child below the age of 17. So 17 and younger. You get those even if you're above 75,000 or above 150,000, but it starts to get phased out for the child payments. So a family with two children would no longer be eligible for payments if their income was above 218,000. Okay. Do college students get anything? If you're under the age of 24, and over the age of, you are an adult, you'll get something as long as you're not a dependent. If you're filed as a dependent, there'll be a weird setup there. The $1,200 might go to the people who are your custodians. We'll see how that works out. There's a lot of stuff that the IRS is going to have to figure out how to do here.
Let me check something here if I could.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's probably a donut hole in this thing. In other words, if you filed, let's say you've already filed your tax return for last year, or your tax return, and you make too much money to get the check, but you've lost your job, the person you were talking about, it's entirely possible you're not eligible to get the check because you made a lot of money.
Right. Well, you'll be eligible later to get it, but not in the first mail out.
The point I want to make here is we've been preaching this for years, and we're going to continue to preach it, just because there's a tendency when you make a lot of money and everything is going real well to not have any savings.
Yeah. It seems weird. A lot of people that have not been in that situation look at it and say, well, how could that ever happen? I would certainly do it. Expenses tend to rise with your income.
I've had people say to me, I don't need to have savings. I have these credit cards. Well, now they're learning that may not be too good.
Right. Having
really
reserves
important.
On hand is vital.
It's really important to learn from this event. It's really important to learn, even retirement, and when you're working, it doesn't make any difference when. Having a good reserve, we like to have more for our clients, but minimum of 6 months reserve, so that if you lose your job, you can continue to function for 6 months. Now, if you're working for the government or someplace where you're not likely to ever lose your job, 3 months is probably good enough, but the important thing is that people need to have a cash reserve because unexpected things happen. And we just had a big unexpected thing happen, and people were just not. I think there's a lot of people who are going to be in a world of hurt financially. Yeah.
And what we're saying to you all is, remember this. This is how we learn. Unfortunately, it takes getting our knees skinned before we really take it seriously that reserves are important. A lot of people, Generation X, Generation the Millennials, haven't been through a period where they've been laid off. They may remember it, other people getting laid off in the Great Recession, but they've been so far immune to this stuff. There's been this huge buying trend for a decade. That's the entire career of a lot of people, and we're about out of time. If you'd like to call our office and talk to us personally, we give investment advice to individuals. The local number is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can go through the contact form there or email us directly at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. And if you're, we've got a question hanging out there for next hour. Until then, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thank you very much for listening. We've got a lot more to talk about next hour.